You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Now, this interview is a long time coming, just so everybody knows. I got an email a couple years ago, out of the blue one day, from a guy I had only heard about and never met. And I had only heard about him spoken with Reverie. And he told me that he listened to All Marine Radio, that he enjoyed it, to keep up the good work. And so joining us now is the man, the myth, the legend, Mike Marletto. Mike, well, hold on, Colonel Mike Marletto, United States Marine Corps retired. Mike, first of all, good morning down under. How are you?
Great, Mac. Good talking to you. And appreciate the opportunity. I figure you're probably just now, you're scraping the bottom of the barrel that you finally got around to asking me to come on and talk. But I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, before we go any further, do you want to talk about your Dodgers or not?
Well, that's very painful, of course, and I'm a little down on the organization right now because I'm not convinced that they're all about winning a World Series, and, you know, they've brought over some Stan Kasten, who was the, you know, president of the Atlanta Braves, is the head of the Dodgers now, and, you know, he, of course, won lots of division championships in Atlanta, and I think they won 14 in a row and only won one World Series, and that seems to be the organizational philosophy the Dodgers have right now. So I'm a little down on them, but I'll stay true.
You don't have a choice. You have to. But there's been, and you and I have talked about a little bit, much hullabaloo about Dave Roberts keeping his job with the Dodgers, and you and I have talked about it, but I'll say this again. His pitching decisions in the playoffs, I don't think that they came as a surprise to anybody in that front office. I don't think he has the latitude, and I think that's why he didn't get fired. And when you watch the fact that they thought that they could get to the World Series with Kenley Jensen, who'd struggled throughout the whole season, and that was going to be the way that the Los Angeles Dodgers, with all the talent on that roster and all the money that franchise has now, that was weak. That was a weak effort for what, about the third year, and you should hear this. I don't need to tell you, but the Dodger fans are beside themselves. We beat ourselves what 3 years in a row now, Mike. Nobody, the other team, I mean, has won. But we feel like we made gigantic mistakes in critical situations relative to personnel and didn't give ourselves a chance to win and ultimately lost.
I think Dave Roberts is probably, he's a great human being. Probably would love to have him living next door to me, but I'm not sure I want him making the decisions in the World Series, as he's shown all through his 4 years of that he's been a manager. So, yeah I mean, when he sent Kershaw out to pitch to with Rendon and Soto coming up, I actually was talking to a friend of mine. I said, one of these guys is going to take him deep. Little did I know they both would on successive pitches. So that was probably one of the most painful moments I've ever had as a Dodgers fan, even more painful than Jack Clark taking Tom Needy deep in 85.
Well, at least you knew that was Lasorda's gut, right? I mean, Lasorda, right. I mean, and his forte was not handling the bullpen. And he had first base open and arguably the best, the most productive hitter in the National League. And the good news for Niedenfuhr is that it wasn't a cheapie, right? It didn't just barely get over. It was halfway up that pavilion with first base open. And you just watch it thinking, I cannot believe that just happened. So
I say, I think the Dodger Nation longs for the days of Walter Alston. So
there you go, Walter Alston. Okay, let's talk about you now. So, Mike, born and raised where?
I was born in Oakland, California, but really raised next door in San Leandro, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area over in the East Bay.
All right, so what, south of Oakland, yes?
Just, yeah, right, just south of Oakland. So, Yeah, I probably grew up about 10 miles away from the Oakland Coliseum, where I know your dad, you know, plied his trade. I remember, you know, the A's when they moved there in 68, the first season, you know, going to games there, and, you know, all the time I was growing up.
Mike, also, I used to attend a lot of... we were probably in that stadium at the same time as kids.
Yeah, probably. I remember they had McNamara's band.
Yeah. McNamara's band right before, you know, the year before he got fired in 1970. And then the A's go on to rip off about, what, every division championship and a whole bunch of World Series. So life with fate was not kind.
Yeah, I guess your dad probably got some post-traumatic stress from working for Charlie Finley.
Oh, yeah. You don't even know. I mean, he... Finley was a tough guy, and he was a showman and all the rest of it. And yeah, pretty interesting stories about the way he dealt with Reggie Jackson. Reggie Jackson hit 47 home runs, I think, in 69, and he wanted to get paid $100,000, which is what Hank Aaron was made, because I want to say he hit more home runs than Hank Aaron that year. And Finley said, not even no, but hell no. And I want to say, think the major league minimum was like $20,000 a year. And ultimately, he winds up paying Jackson $1,000 for every home run he hit that year, which was $47,000 he made. And he held out. And Finley told my dad, you can't play him more than, I think, two or three times a week. That's all you can play him. And then the game on the Sunday before the All-Star break. So they're playing in Oakland. Reggie hits a pinch hit, three-run home run. And Finley's in his box at the Coliseum. And when Reggie steps on the plate, he looks at this, he looks up Finley's box and he flips him off. And then the first game after the All-Star break was in Chicago, which is Finley's hometown, playing the White Sox. And Finley had Reggie in tears. He told him he would put him out of baseball, he would blackball him, that he owned him just as much as he owned anything at that Coliseum. And if he thought he would do that, and here's a letter, and you're going to sign it, and you're going to shut your mouth. And my dad said, absolutely brutal. Absolutely brutal. So, yeah, you don't know how right you are, you know, back in the day when, you know, before the reserve clause got challenged by Kurt Flood and Andy Messersmith, you know, they owned you. And if you pissed them off, they could bury you. So, yes, yeah. How does, how does the Marine Corps get on your radar as a kid?
Well, you know, growing up in the early 60s, you know, in a working class, you know, neighborhood, everyone's parents back then were, you know, World War II, or, you know, the younger parents were Korean, you know, veterans. So there was a lot of, you know, military, you know, exposure. My father had served in the Army Air Corps in World War II. He'd been drafted, but he never left the States. He was assigned to a training base down in Marfa, Texas. But, you know, so he had a lot of folks that had been in the military. And, of course, you know, you're talking about really, you know, 15 years or so after World War II. So you had all these things on TV, you know, Victory at Sea, Silent Service. You know, you had TV shows like Combat, 12 O'Clock High. So there's a lot of military stuff going on. So I was kind of always fascinated by that as a kid. And even more so, I was fascinated by, you know, some people are into trains, some are into planes and cars. I was into ships. So in the San Francisco Bay Area at the time, they had a, you know, a large military presence in the Bay Area. And right. So the Navy used to come in all the time with ships and go down and, you know, I'd visit them. My dad would take me down there. So, I mean, I went on amphibs, submarines, cruisers, you know, aircraft carriers. And so just kind of fed that. But
now, was your dad a veteran?
He was. He served in the Army Air Corps in World War II. As I said, he never left the States, though.
Okay.
He was at a training base in Texas.
Got it.
So, you know, but I didn't know any, you know, Marines. I mean, my exposure to the Marines was there was a show on for a little while called The Lieutenant on NBC, which was about a Marine lieutenant at, I believe it was at Camp Pendleton. And, you know, I mean, so I really didn't know anything about the Marine Corps. And quite frankly, is, you know, you got into the late 60s and 70s, the San Francisco Bay Area wasn't exactly a hotbed of support for the military. And so, I was going to college at Cal State Hayward and started college. Really didn't know what I was going to do, but, you know, I was going through college, and I got cold called by a Marine Corps recruiter, you know, when I was home on, I think it was the Christmas break. And so he gave me, started giving me a spiel, and I said, hey, listen, I'm not really interested in enlisting, you know, in the Marine Corps. I'm, you know, going to college. And he said, oh, you're going to college. Have you ever thought about becoming an officer? And I was like, what? You know, he said, yeah, we've got this thing called the platoon leaders class. And he started explaining it to me. So to this recruiter's credit, I mean, he wasn't going to, you know, get me to enlist, but he was smart enough to, you know, to shift gears. And he said, I'll put you in contact with the officer selection office. And he did. And they said, you know, they called me and they said, hey, listen, you know, you're on not doing anything for the next couple weeks. Why don't you come down and take the test? And so I said, yeah, sure. So I did. And, you know, the rest, as they say, is history. So that's, yeah, I just got cold. I was a cold call by a recruiter.
Wow. Well, but you know what? I mean, just as Mike says, you know, when we grew up, everybody was a veteran. When you went to the Veterans Day Parade or Memorial Day Parade, there was no men standing on the sidewalk. I mean, they were in the parade. And guys who were standing on the sidewalk normally did not want to talk about why they were not in the parade. You know, it was because it's normally not a very good story. It was not a positive story that they cared to talk about. And, you know, sometimes it was flat feet, sometimes it was other stuff, but it was not something that was a good thing that they enjoyed speaking of. And so, in that sense, everybody thought they would serve at least all. And then, you know, the draft was still part of our lives and whatnot. So it's a question of, you know, when you were going to serve. So what year do you actually, when do you go to OCS in the basic school?
I went to OCS, and I went to the PLC combined course, you know, the 10-week course.
Right.
I went in 76. So it's kind of nice, you know, to be in D.C. during the bicentennial.
Yeah.
You know, I was able to see the bicentennial fireworks and, you know, on weekend Libo. I went to OCS in 76, and then I graduated in 1977 and went off to the basic school in August of 1977.
What did you want to be when it sounds like you knew about as much about the Marine Corps as I did? You know, you forgot Rat Patrol when you were naming all those TV shows.
Yeah, Rat Patrol and Garrison's Guerrillas.
Garrison's Guerrillas, yeah. How did you figure out? Did you want to be an Arctic guy? Did you really want to be a grunt? And you got shit canned to the Arctic? How did that all happen? Behind the curtain. How did you become an Arctic guy?
I'll take you behind the curtain. When I went to OCS, we had several MESEPs, you know, Marine Enlisted Commissioning Program guys in my platoon, and one of them was I think he was actually a gunny. And he was an artillery scout observer, 0861, and had served in Anglico Air Naval Gunfire Liaison Company for those who aren't familiar with that. And so this guy was very impressive, and he talked a lot about, you know, getting to know him a little bit. It was, you know, that kind of sounds like something I would be interested in. And I liked it because I thought, you know, hey, artillery's got a technical side to it. You know, you've got to shoot these rounds, you know, at targets that you can't see, at, you know, many miles away. And so there's a technical part that you've got to be familiar with. And then there's also the tactical part where you've got to be able to plan and integrate and support of your, you know, the scheme of maneuver and the maneuver units. And so I liked it because it had both those, you know, components. So when I got to TBS, I knew that my first choice was going to be artillery, and I was fortunate enough to, you know, put in for artillery and get my first choice.
Were you trying to imply that, like, infantry doesn't have its technical side to it? Was that not so subtle dig at that?
Well, you know, I know logistics for, you know, you guys is hey, we got we're going out to the field with my platoon, so I need two cases of MREs.
Yeah, well, no need to go there. No need to go there. The all right, well, let's talk about your career. So, give us the wave tops of your career, give us the wave tops of your career, Mike.
So, the good thing was I got my first choice in, MOS, and at the time I didn't think it was so great. I got my first duty station assignment to 29 Palms, California. And so in 1978, by the time I, finished basic school and finished artillery school at SIL, I checked in, to 29 Palms in August of 1978. And I remember driving down the, through the town there at, 7:30 in the morning, driving past the, the sign at the Bank of America with the temperature on, and it was 118 degrees. And I was thinking, what the hell have I got myself into? And, 29 Palms was a pretty austere location at that time, from a, a social and, off-duty standpoint. But from a professional standpoint, it was probably the best place that a new artillery officer, could go to. I was assigned to 3rd 175 Gun Battery, 3rd Guns, and I was there in September of 78. We did the last, at the time they were called palm tree exercises, which was the forerunner of the CASH program. And then in October of 78, I was on the first official combined arms exercise, CACH 1-79. So the bottom line is we spent a lot of time in the field, and 29 Palms at that time was, the wide open spaces. We could call up on a day's notice and say we want to go out for a battery shoot later in the week, and we could, get half the base for our, training and airspace up to 30,000 feet. So it was just a phenomenal place. And then the topper on that was 3rd Guns at the time. The Marine Corps at one time had 3 175 gun batteries, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. 2nd Guns was at Lejeune. 1st and 3rd Guns were at 29 Palms, and they were all being retubed to 8-inch. And so 2nd Guns had gone away and become an 8-inch battery, and 1st Guns had been retubed to 2nd 8-inch just prior to me getting there. And so in 3rd Guns, we got a call one day, and it was, they said, hey, listen, we've got 100,000 175 rounds down at Fallbrook at the ammo dump that, we need to get rid of because the 75s are ultimately going away. So you guys no longer have any kind of ammo allocation. You can shoot as much as you want. So when we would go out and support a CACS, we'd have more rounds to fire than the, the O5 unit that was supporting the maneuver. So, it was great as a, as a young artillery officer to just be able to bang away and learn your skills.
Yeah. All right, take it from there. So from there, I tell you, you can't underestimate, because some people don't, just don't get the reps. I mean, you see what's going on, the problems the Marine Corps aviation community is having now, because you have pilots that don't have the reps, and some of the accidents you see are a result that, of, the cumulative effect of when you don't get the reps that you need to get in this part of your career, it echoes into that. So to be able to go out there and learn it like that, I mean, you can't say how important that is to be able to operate and learn those lessons. Where does life take you after that?
So, Mac, I didn't know anything about the Marine Corps when I came in. As a matter of fact, I didn't even know there was a difference between regular and reserve officers when I showed up at, TBS. I remember I showed up and first day there in the chow hall, and there's a, guy in my company, and he was a ROTC guy from, Illinois, and he was wearing a set of jump wings. And I said, hey, that's pretty cool. How'd you get a set of jump wings? And he said, well, I was in ROTC, and I went to jump school, in the summer or winter or wherever you went. And the guy said, and oh, by the way, I'm a regular officer. And I was like, what? Well, what do you mean? We're both second lieutenants. He said, no, I'm a regular. You're a reserve. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? And he said, well, I serve indefinitely. You've got an end of active service. I'm like, oh, wow, really? So, to me at the time, it didn't mean anything because my plan had been to, I was going to come in the Marine Corps, have a little adventure try to see a little bit of the world. And then I was going to, get out and get a real job. And so, I got to 29 Palms, really enjoyed, what I was doing and said, boy, I'd kind of like to do this a little more. And so, the problem was by the time I got to the, to the fleet, I had already burned up a year of, I only had a 2.5 year active duty obligation because that's how desperate they were to, get guys to come on active duty at the time. So, I mean, I had, by the time I was at 29 Palms, I was burning through all my obligated time, but I only had like one or two fitness reports. Fitness reports then, I think we had semi-annual reports, and then you might get a change of duty report and stuff. And so I decided I wanted to try and augment, but when we got briefed on augmentation, I honestly looked and said, there's no way I'm going to get augmented because I don't have enough fitness reports. So if I'm lucky, maybe I'll get an extension on active duty. And so first time I applied, they said, okay, we're going to give you a 1 year extension on active duty. And so I said, okay, that's great. I still want to see some of the world. And by this time, I had, met a lot of Marines. And, at the time, I said, geez, I don't really think you're a Marine. And, the feeling was until you'd served overseas and, gone to Okinawa. So I called up the monitor and said, hey, I just got this 1 year EAD. Can you send me to Okinawa? And he said, wow, yeah, I'm always looking for volunteers to go to Okinawa. So so off I went. And so I got to Okinawa, and I was joined Hotel Battery, 3rd Battalion, 12th Marines. I was fortunate enough that, I think it's a lot of guys would go over there after their initial fleet tour and maybe end up getting fapped out to a, base job. I was fortunate enough that I got, down to 12th Marines and also did get put into a battalion staff position. So I was able to, spend another year, again, learning my craft, and shooting, 105s, which, was a big transition from self-propelled artillery going to, a small towed, weapon system. So, I learned, got a chance, spent about 5 months off island, made a couple deployments down to the Philippines, and so had a, had a great time during my year in Okinawa.
So as a lieutenant, you're pretty solid. Tell me about your commands going forward.
Okay, well, I went off to Fort Sill after I left Okinawa, which, I hear you talk about guys serving at IOC. Well, for the artillery community, serving at Fort Sill is kind of the equivalent of, serving out at IOC. So once again, you learn all your skills. And so I'm at Fort Sill, and while I'm at Fort Sill, I had the fortune to teach in two different departments. I taught in target acquisition, where I learned about employing target acquisition devices, and then I got moved over to the tactics department, and I was teaching artillery tactics to the advanced course. And the reason I need to deviate here, because this is where my career kind of deviated. 1983, I'm sitting at Fort Sill in August of 83. I get a call on a Saturday morning about 8 o'clock from Lieutenant Colonel Smith, who was my boss in the tactics department. He said, hey, I need you to come over to the house right away. And I'm thinking, oh, shit, what have I done? So I go over, and he said, hey, if you've read, they've been following what's going on in the papers, the Marines over in Beirut are getting, you know, they're sitting down at the airport and they're getting shot at by artillery, and they're starting to take artillery and rocket fire, and they need some more advanced target acquisition capabilities than what they've got over there. At the time, the firefighter radar of the Q-36 was a brand new piece of gear, and its big brother was the Q-37, which was even bigger and optimized for locating artillery. Those systems were so new that they were only being deployed by the Army, and they were, you know, the priority was to put them in the Fulda Gap, you know, and send them to Germany in case the Russian horde came across the German border. So the only other systems were there at Fort Sill, so they said DOD's made a decision that they're going to basically send some systems from here at Fort Sill over to Lebanon, and because these are all soldiers, they need, you know, a Marine to be able to, you know, translate Marinese to Army and vice versa. And so, you know, you've got a background in target acquisition, you've taught the systems, so pack your trash, you're going to Beirut. So off I went.
Talk to us about that. I mean, we could probably unpack that one and do a show, but give me a couple lessons from the perspective. And when did you get there, Mike?
I got there in late August of 83. We deployed with two Firefinder radar systems. I was attached to the battalion headquarters, and I was basically running the target processing section in the battalion headquarters. And it was funny because we would take fire. We would have flurries of fire where, you know, I remember one day stuff was just flying back and forth, and we couldn't even process the volume of target, rounds that were being fired. There were so many. So one of the lessons learned that we had was we told them that, you know, you need to come up with a way. This is an automated system. You need to be able to prioritize the targets by where they're impacting. And so ultimately they came up with a thing called the critical friendly zone, which prioritizes the radar acquisitions by, you know, where the rounds are impacting. So if they're shooting at you, those are the rounds you want to know where they're coming from. So that was one of the, you know, positive outcomes there. So, I was very fortunate in that I spent one night out of the BLT building during my time over there, and that was the night of October 22nd, and we know what happened on the 23rd. So,
are you shitting me? But for the grace of God, there go you.
Yeah, grace of God and roll of the dice. I was not killed in that explosion. So,
otherwise, you're there sleeping like everybody else, and
exactly, yeah. Wow. And unfortunately, we had some folks from our from the Army unit that had, you know, where I was very lucky, they were unlucky. They had driven down to pick up a radar tech who had come ashore off the New Jersey to help with one of the radars was having some problems, and he came ashore and he said, "Hey, listen, we were allowed to, you know, we had a little club in the headquarters and you could drink two beers." And so this guy came ashore and said, "Hey, I haven't had a beer in, you know, 6 months. How about you guys come pick me up in the morning instead of," he arrived there Saturday. So, he'd spend the night here and drink two beers. And as a result, the guys to pick him up showed up probably about 10 minutes before the bomb hit, and he was killed, and both our guys that showed up to pick him up were killed, and, we had another, our youngest soldier was killed. He was in the target processing section. We lost, there was another Marine warrant officer who had come out from Fort Sill with us. He was killed, and we had a Sergeant First Class who, I guess as you look at it, one side of the building, guys kind of got blown out, and that's where some guys survived, and he was fortunate enough, he was wounded, but he survived. So I was, again, very lucky.
We're not supposed to deviate from the plan you and I laid out, but let me ask you a question. I mean, one of the things that, you know, when we talk about post-traumatic winning, one of the things that haunts people that they struggle with throughout life is the randomness that occurs in combat. And your life is a walking example of it. Have you ever made peace with it? What I learned was that, look, yeah, it's the God who governs the flight of metal and the fate of people is a fickle, you know, God. And that's about as good as you're ever going to get. And if you're looking for a deeper answer, guess what? It isn't there. You were lucky, period. I wondered I remember watching Band of Brothers and is Lieutenant Spears talks to that Private Blythe who has these trauma blackout, and he looks at me and goes, Blythe, you have to realize that you're already dead. And until you realize that, you won't be able to function as a soldier. And Blythe looks at him like, okay. I think it resonates with people that have had to try to deal with the randomness and am I going to be able to duck in time? Am I going to live? Am I going to be able to die? Am I going to die? And then all the stuff you see, people that shouldn't be dead that are, people that know, you know, should certainly be dead are not. How have you navigated that?
Well, you know, certainly you live with that. And part of the way I dealt with it is, you know, I kind of committed myself that I was given an opportunity that, you know, 241 other folks were not. And I was going to make the most of that. So some of the things that I saw that, you know, I was going to be diligent in learning my profession. And interestingly enough, I always said if I ever went back to the Middle East, I wanted to go back with one MEF where the gloves were off and, we were able to engage under less stringent rules of engagement. And I got that opportunity in 2003. But in the meantime, what it kind of dedicated me to, Mac, was to really focus on training and, the nuts and bolts of training, and that you have to take advantage because you never know what is going to happen. And in this case, the worst case was worse than anyone could have imagined. You know, there was always a threat of car bombs out there, but I don't think anyone imagined the largest conventional bomb that had ever gone off up to that point happening. So, kind of always left me with, you know, the worst thing you can imagine, there's probably something worse out there. But so some of the things, I became very strict on training, and because, you know, we had had guards there that weren't allowed to have a, you know, magazine in their weapon with a chambered round because of the number of negligent discharges they had had. So I kind of committed myself that I wasn't ever going to let that happen to a unit that, I was in. So I'd like to think that, you know, some positive things I was able to take away and apply as I've gone through life subsequently.
Wow. All right, you come back from that experience. Holy shit, man. You obviously get retained in the Marine Corps. Tell us about augmentation, which at the time, around that time, actually I was at Officer Candidate School at that time. A lot of people that were retained were forced into other MOSs. Was that system in place?
No, I had got augmented while I was in Okinawa.
Okay,
so my second time I applied for augmentation in Okinawa, I got augmented. And so I became, I was a regular officer, and then I was able to get an assignment to Fort Sill. Then I kind of deviated. Instead of, I thought I was going to go back to the fleet. I got pulled up to headquarters, Marine Corps, to work in manpower. And so I finally got back to the fleet as a very, senior, captain, which, had some great advantages. I had a lot more, I had seen a lot more things, knew a lot more about the Marine Corps than a lot of my contemporaries. So I was able to get back out to Camp Pendleton, get to Pendleton actually for the first time to 11th Marines. And at the time, 311 was, still at Pendleton. And so I went to 311, and there I was able to get battery command of hotel battery 311, take them on a unit deployment. And from there, went off to Command and General Staff College, ended up staying for a second year at Leavenworth, going to the School of Advanced Military Studies. From there, I went back to Okinawa to 3MEF, where I ended up being the assistant OIC of 3MEF SOTG. So I got a look at all the MUSOC kind of stuff, and interesting, kind of broadened my perspectives there. Off to Central Command, and then from Central Command, I got selected for battalion command, went back to Pendleton, and had command of 211 for 2 years in the late 90s.
All right, keep going.
So from there, I got selected for top-level school. I went to National War College. So coming out of National War College, I was one of those guys who was kind of unique in that I was post-command, and I had also had a joint tour. So where everyone else was being sent on joint tours coming out of school, I was kind of a wild card. And so I talked to the monitor, and I said, hey, listen, you know, I'd be interested in, you know, I've seen the Army's BCTP program, Battlefield Command Training Program, and I know the Marine Corps has got a program that they started up after Desert Storm called the MAGTAF Staff Training Program, MSTP, down at Quantico. I'd really be interested in, you know, going down there. And so the monitor was good enough to send me down to Quantico to MSTP. And so I spent 3 years at MSTP and was able to see, you know, every MEF in the Marine Corps in action several times on, you know, so, and basically it was great because, once again, it's kind of like when you're an instructor, you know, you're talking about war fighting every day, and it was the same right. thing at MSTP. You know, every day we were talking about, you know, war fighting and war fighting processes for 3 years. So I then got, from there, I got selected in 2002 to take command of the 11th Marines. And so off I went to the 11th Marines in 2000, and we ended up then, of course, deploying to Iraq in 2003.
All right. Keep going. Finish us off.
So coming back from... OIF, I had another year left in command, which we spent most of that time preparing, you know, starting to prepare units. We sent 311, and they were followed. I know you talked to Mike Frazier,
right.
Followed by 211 going over to do in lieu of, you know, missions. So at the same time, we were still trying to maintain our artillery proficiency, but that was getting, you know, tougher and tougher because we're, you know, maintaining unit deployment, we're maintaining the MU deployments, and we've got one battalion that's, you know, going out on, you know, in Iraq, and we've got another preparing to go. So, you know, that didn't leave us a lot back in the rear to, you know, train with. So we were able to do some creative things. You know, we got a Marine Reserve battalion that trained with us. When we went out to the desert, we had an Army MLRS battalion come out from, you know, Fort Sill. So able to, you know, give us enough units out there so we could try and maintain the regiment's proficiency at, you know, doing fire support at a time when, you know, everyone else was shifting focus to, you know, stability type, you know, operations.
What, now that's that was a challenge, Mike, because you guys, you know, you guys were the Swiss Army knife in Iraq. I mean, from running clearance patrols to moving the mother of all generators, where I met Mike Frazier, to all the other things. You know, our artillery battalions, they and you know they'd have what a battery, maybe a platoon firing, because we weren't at the time. You know, our munitions were such that we were not shooting very much into cities. We'd shoot into outlying areas around Fallujah and Ramadi. I mean, some into the cities, but not like we did later on in the war. that had to be not so easy. And then, but I don't want to get into a discussion on it. So you finish that, and then you go, you come home, you go to the MEF, yes?
I go up to the MEF, and I was supposed to become the MEF G3 and deploy over there in the summer of 2004. But unfortunately, my wife was diagnosed with cancer, and at the time, it was initially diagnosed that it was going to be, you know, a very slow-growing thing. It was all going to be manageable. Well, unfortunately, it didn't turn out that way, and so I had to say, hey, I can't deploy. I've got to deal with this family issue. So I got slid over. When I went up to the MEF, they put me into what was called the G9, which was the science and technology guys, where, you know, everyone and his uncle was coming out of the, you know, the woodwork saying, hey, I've got the device that's going to allow you to find IEDs. You know, I've got this, I've got the software that's going to allow you to talk to the Iraqis. And, you know, so we were being bombarded with all of these, you know, technological solutions that everyone was trying to sell to the government. So, you know, I was in charge of, wading through that. So ultimately, unfortunately, my wife did end up passing away. So I later, you know, I could have stayed as the, you know, at the MEF kind of doing, you know, nuts and bolts type stuff like that. And then, you know, the Marine Corps was very good about taking care of folks when they've got, you know, family issues. But, you know, as the MEF was getting ready to deploy again about a year later, you know, I said to myself, you know, I can't in my right mind sit here and watch guys go out the door and, you know, bid goodbye to guys that I've been, you know, working with. So, you know, I talked to the General Halick at the time, was the deputy CG, and I said, hey, listen, I'm, you know, ready to, you know, to basically, you know, deploy. And so they said, okay, well, you know, you were supposed to be the G3, and we need, you know, need a new G3. So they made me the G3, so I deployed back over in 2006 as the G3 of 1F4.
All right, and when do you retire?
So I did my 1 year over in Iraq. I came back, and I had about a year to go to retire, and so, you know, the monitor wasn't going to move me anywhere, and so I said, hey, how about sending me over to base, you know, base Pendleton for my last year. So I went over to base, and my boss there had actually been one of my battalion commanders, and he said, hey, listen, we're having problems with, we're trying to do a base master plan, and we just, you know, the contractors just aren't giving us what we want, and I know you've got a planning background, so would you mind, you know, kind of taking charge of this master planning effort? And so I said, yeah, sure, I'd love to do that. So I did that, worked with the contractors for a year producing the Pendleton base master plan, and so ultimately I guess the contractors kind of liked what I was doing, and so they offered me a job when I retired. And off I went, and I spent 10 years working on basing in the Western Pacific, helping develop the new bases and training areas in Guam and the Marianas Islands, and also did base consolidation planning for Okinawa, and also did a master plan for the naval base of Yokosuka. So I did that for 10 years, and then finally got my daughter through university, and as they say down here, she went to school down in Australia, and so I said, that's it, I'm done. And in January of 2019, I hung it up and retired.
So now you're retired, and you split time between Australia and the United States.
That's it, yep. Trying to figure out what I want to do besides, follow baseball at a level that I've never been able to follow before.
I'd like to, I want to talk about the march up a little bit. I know a lot of people are interested in your role as a CO of 11th Marines. is a let me just tell you, you know, when I talked to Tavuchis, who's the CEO of Marines, what's his appropriate title at Fort Sill? What would we call
him? I think he's CEO of the Mardet Marine Detachment.
He would give himself a much more exalted title than that. The Grand Poobah of artillery. Vooch would have something ginormous to say about himself. Mike Frazier, though, I mean, when your name comes up, they're like, Matt, do not say Marletto's name from your grunt mouth, okay? So, anyway, that's why I'm enjoying this. But no, you what you did in the march up. Can you talk to us about the march up a little bit? What was, relative to artillery, what was the major problem that you, as you saw it, that you would contribute a solution to? What was the most complex thing that you dealt with? And was there anything that surprised you about the experience? So we'll start with the first one. What was the biggest problem as a division fire support coordinator that you ran into?
Well, as everyone looked at the Iraqi order of battle and the Iraqi army, it wasn't just the artillery. You know, going back to Desert Storm, everyone had always said that the Iraqi strength was their artillery, and so that was identified by General Mattis as the tactical center of gravity was his artillery. And so all the maneuver commanders were confident that, you know, if you can take care of his artillery, we can close with and destroy him. You know, we're not worried about, you know, beating him in it, you know, as we close into direct fire range. So we need his artillery, you know, shut down. So the 11th Marines, we said, okay, we're going to take that on board, and we will, as we, you know, euphemistically said, we'll provide the shield for the division, and, you know, so the, you know, maneuver guys can apply the sword. And so we took that on. And so, and we also said that we're not just going to suppress his artillery and shut him, you know, when we find him. We're going to kill him. Because when we find something, we want to knock him out, and we want to, you know, basically eliminate that threat off the battlefield, because you don't want to allow him, you know, shoot back just to suppress him, allow him to displace, and then you've got to acquire him again. So when we acquire him, we want to kill him. So we came up with and we knew that, you know, that we were, you know, we had a good lay down on the enemy, and we knew that we were going to be able to do some, you know, a lot of shaping, or potentially a lot of shaping. At the end, you know, it ended up being a rolling start, so it wasn't, you know, as we did more and more planning, we knew that we weren't going to have a 40-day shaping effort like they had in Desert Storm, that it was going to be a, you know, a much more of a rolling rolling start. So, you know, when you started counting up the weapon systems, you knew that, okay, we're going to be able to take some of this stuff out proactively with air and also potentially with some long-range rocket strikes. But we're not going to get it all, because we're not going to have the aviation, the amount of aviation that they had in Desert Storm, you know, stacked up, just waiting to be tasked. And as you started to look at all of the things that they were asking aviation to do in the deep fight, it became obvious that, you know, there's going to be artillery out there that is not going to get addressed, you know, in the proactive chafing effort, and we're going to have to take these guys out reactively, and we want to do that as fast as possible. So we knew that we could capitalize on the automated command and control systems that had been developed in the artillery, and then we also knew that we could meld in the power of the MAGTAF, and so we developed a reactive counterfire. We called it the reactive counterfire battle drill, where one of our radars located a target, we would immediately put artillery on it. At the same time, we would request air, because we knew that although artillery had a good opportunity to kill it, you know, we only had electronic eyes on it. We didn't have visual eyes on it. So when aviation could roll in, if we didn't kill that guy, if he was trying to displace, aviation could finish him off. And, oh, by the way, they could put eyes on target and let us know if we had, you know, killed them. So that was the biggest challenge we had, and what we you know, were trained to and took forward as we were heading into OIF.
All right, so that was the challenge. Give me something that surprised you that you learned. You're obviously a studious guy and a student of your profession. What did you learn, Mike, that you didn't know?
Well, two things I learned. One was, you know, the munitions that we have are a lot more effective than I ever even imagined. When we fired things like improved conventional munitions and massed multiple firing units on a target, in the words of the grunts, those targets would be vaporized. They just ceased to exist. There was nothing left of them. And I personally saw that watching us engage a tank unit, an armored unit with ICM over with a RPV over it. So I was watching the RPV feed as our, you know, rounds were coming in. And it's interesting to watch when ICM comes in, it ends up in a circular pattern. So I was sitting next
Mike,
to
could you. Could you explain ICM for people that may not be familiar?
ICM is improved conventional munitions. It's instead of a 155 round going out with a HE filler and making a big bang and throwing fragmentation in a 50-meter direction, ICM is a what we call a base ejecting round, where it's got a time fuse on it, and when the time goes off, it kicks off the back of the projectile and spits out whatever inside. So, you know, an illumination round, smoke rounds, those are all base ejecting rounds. In the case of ICM, you've got 88 bomblets that are loaded into that round, and when they come out, each bomblet has a little streamer that stabilizes it. It's got a shape charge on the bottom that will, when it hits, it will fires and will penetrate anything that it hits, for example, armor or, you know, a bunker. And then at the same time, when it hits, it pops up a fragmentation grenade. So essentially, if you've got an armor unit with dismounted infantry, the shape charge takes care of the armor and the fragmentation takes care of the personnel.
Got it. Okay. So, talk about...
When it pops out, it ends up laying... comes out in a circular pattern. So I was sitting there next to the intel analyst, and we fired our first volley, and you see the circular pattern come out, and he said, "Hey, sir, looks like you guys missed." And then the next volley came in, and on the screen it washes out as the tank explodes, you know, from the shape charges hitting it and detonating the ammo inside. And I just turned to him and said, "Well, I guess we didn't miss with that one." So time and time again, you just had guys telling the story of, you know, and FOs and maneuver commanders talking about the effects that they saw on the battlefield. So that's one thing that surprised me, is how much more lethal our ammunition was, because you don't get to shoot that stuff in training.
Right.
And you certainly don't get to shoot it against live targets. And then the second thing that surprised me, Mac, was, you know, what didn't happen was I was convinced that, you know, we were going to have to operate in degraded environments, in particular, that we were going to lose GPS signals at times, that, you know, GPS is, you know, relatively easy to jam just because of the low power of the signal. So I thought, you know, hey, Saddam's got to have learned the lessons from, Desert Storm, that we were able to make this big end run in his featureless desert because we had GPS. So, you know, he's got to be able to put some jammers out there that are going to deny us GPS, which is going to affect our, you know, not only our land nav, but potentially our survey capability. And, you know, he did try to use some GPS jammers in Baghdad against early on, I think, against, some of the aviation that was using GPS weapons there. But we never saw that. So that was a big surprise to me. And then I'll give you a third surprise, and that was everyone thought that this was going to be, as they called it, the Battle of the Bridges.
Right.
We had a bunch of major water obstacles to cross, including, you know, you had the Euphrates River, you had the Tigris River, in between you had the Saddam Canal, and that, you know, he was going to knock down these bridges, and we were going to have a huge bridging effort to get across the bridges. And in particular, I was worried because, you know, artillery, hey, the king doesn't swim. So, you know, we were going to potentially be held up while the engineers were getting in, you know, bridging. And in fact, they stood up, for all intents and purposes, a CB division with all of these bridging assets, because they thought we were going to have to just cross all these water obstacles. And then tied in with that was the threat that he was going to release water out of places like, you know, the Haditha Dam that you're familiar with.
Right.
And he was going to inundate low-lying areas because he had done that, you know, he had done that in the past in the Iran-Iraq war. And so, you know, there was a concern if he inundated areas, well, we're not going to have any position areas that we're going to be able to occupy because they're all going to be underwater. So for whatever reasons, he didn't do that. And I don't know if anyone's ever studied why that didn't happen. You know, did he not, you know, was he holding that that decision-making at those higher levels? So, you know, that was the third surprise I had. He did finally blow some bridges over the Diyala River just outside of Baghdad. So, you know, 1st Marines ended up doing a mini amphibious assault across, and we did some bridging there, and they were able to overbridge one of the bridges that he had, blown a span out of. So, you know, we did finally see it just as we got up to Baghdad. But so those were the three surprises I had: how lethal our weapons were, munitions were, no GPS jamming, and no bridges knocked out on, you know, until we got up to Baghdad.
All right. I want to talk to you about now, kind of switch gears. You've been a teacher. You've been a student. You're guys who know you, you know, speak of you with reverence. For Marines that are part of the combat arms and study and are going to school, let's switch gears and talk about the things that you think they ought to understand about supporting arms, because, you know, pretty lethal world that we now live in today. Just the strides in the last 20 years relative to finding people, relative to killing them with munitions that can hit inside of, you know, a 10 meter circle. That's pretty standard stuff now. Let's talk about what you think professionals ought to know about artillery.
Well, one thing is I would tell them that precision is great, but it's not an end-all. You know, in order for precision weapon to work, you've got to have a precision target location. And so while it's great when you're firing against fixed, you know, targets, you know, you can certainly, as we did, you know, as you probably remember in Ramadi, you know, where we could systematically take down the train station in Ramadi from one end to the other, or we could hit a corner of a building with a precision munition. It's a little more difficult when you start talking about attacking a maneuver formation with a precision weapon. So precision is great, but it's not an end all, and you need other types of munitions and need to know how to employ them, whether it's your mortars, artillery, or just plain, you know, dumb bombs coming off, you know, aircraft. So that's one thing. The second thing I would tell folks is that, you know, the true power of the MAGTAF comes in its ability to simultaneously attack the enemy at his full depth. For a long time, I thought we got taught some, you know, bad lessons where, you know, we had to use all of our supporting arms on a target. You know, you had to shoot it with mortars, you had to put artillery on it, and you had to run air on it, you know, in order to get credit in training for for taking out a target. In the real world, you know, there are targets that artillery can take out. There are targets aviation can take out. You don't always need to be redundant, and not being redundant allows you to attack the enemy in, you know, again, across his full depth. You're able to hit his command and control deep with deep fires, both lethal and, you know, non-lethal. You can use information operations against them, electronic warfare. You know, in a close fight, you can hit them with, you know, artillery. You can hand it off to mortars as you close and finally get in to, you know, direct fire, you know, range. So, you know, to me, that's the true power of the MAGTF, is the power to paralyze an enemy formation by hitting him simultaneously throughout the full depth of his battle space.
The kind of interesting, the whole problem of target acquisition. I want to ask you this because this question comes up on a lot on the program, and that is the whole issue of hypersonic weapons, and you could cross off hypersonic and just put XYZ weapon that is, you know, just shut the lights out. I mean, and we've been doing this kind of spiral. I don't care if you want to talk about tanks. I don't care if you want to talk about rifles. I don't care if you want to talk about, you know, artillery. There is a spiral of technology, right, that goes action, reaction, counteraction. Talk to us about modern lethality and target acquisition. I mean, how does it happen in a peer-to-peer conflict where it would seem to me that one of the first things that's going to happen is everybody's ability to see is going to get negated? How do we do target acquisition? Does it then become what you can generate locally, what we can generate for certain periods of time that may be stealth technology, and we turn it on and shut it off? Can you explain that to us?
Okay, well, yeah, let's talk about that, because this is, again, where you see that sometimes we got to turn to the past, you know, to learn, you know, some lessons. So let's talk about, for example, artillery in the march up. You know, we primarily in the artillery for our counter firefight used radar as our means of detection. It worked in that fight and in the context of that fight because we had studied the Iraqis and we knew that they didn't really have an ability to, you know, to either acquire our radars or to, you know, take them out. Now, you know, a peer, you know, you're fighting the Chinese, you're fighting the Russians, you know, they're going to be able to detect those systems because once they light up, they do have a very large and distinct signature. And you could fire a anti-radiation missile at them and, you know, take them out. So, you know, there are passive systems out there that we've kind of let go by the wayside that, you know, we need to, you know, reinvest in my opinion. So sound ranging, for example, acoustic detection and also flash detection was the way that we located artillery from, you know, indirect fire from World War One, you know, through, you know, Korea before we had radars. That's a completely passive system. And when you say, okay, let's match that with modern information, you know, processing capabilities, there's some phenomenal things that you can do there. And folks like the Russians have continued to invest in modern acoustic systems. So there are passive systems out there that you can invest in that can help you acquire targets. You know, and I would say, you know, you've got drones now that are becoming ubiquitous. You know, we tend to think of them as flying drones, but, you know, heck, ones that crawl along and on the ground and roll along on the ground that could sense things for you, you know, are, you know, potential, you know, solutions. And then the bottom line, hey, Mac, that's why we have recon Marines. Get out there and get human eyeballs on target. You know, we've, you know, for a while there, we let our recon guys, you know, get sucked into being direct action folks. And, you know, hopefully we're now getting back to the fact that their reason for existence is to get out there and, you know, help locate and confirm enemy locations. So I'd say in a lot of cases we've got to, certainly we can use modern technology and everything that brings, but there's some things that we've just got to kind of reinvent the wheel on.
Interesting. No, reinvent the wheel, right?
Exactly.
We got to
reinvent
the wheel. Talk to us when you look at, you know, the peer-to-peer fight and modern lethality. I mean, hell, much of it going on not far from where you live, right? An increased marine presence in northern Australia, the South China Sea. That fight, you know, if there was a fight ever over it, you know, what would it look like? So when you think about, you know, modern cannons and modern artillery, how do you see those fights going on? I've read things that say things like this: the cannon's days are numbered. The rocket will rule the future because of lethality and standoff. That in order for cannons to be effective, unless they're shooting, you know, improved munitions, that their day has come and gone. I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, once again, you've got to have a mix. I mean, rockets are great, great systems. You know, we've got HIMARS now in the Marine Corps, and that's a great system. You know, can reach out a long way. But it's also got, you know, people got to understand, it's got limitations. It's not for a close-in fight. You know, it shoots at a very low trajectory. You've got to be concerned in positioning with terrain, you know, masking, you know, you've on both the firing point end and also on the in the target area, you know, that you get on a reverse slope, you're not going to get hit by a rocket. By the way, you know, it's got to use a shoot and scoot method, because when it fires, it leaves a hellacious signature that, both the rocket itself and also the dust cloud around the launcher. So as a result, you know, those guys got to be shooting, scooting, and moving. And so that puts a demand for, you know, real estate that they've, you know, got to occupy. So rockets are great, but they're not an end-all. You know, when you start talking about, you know, fighting an enemy that may want to close with you and destroy you, you know, hey, I'd like nothing better if I was a maneuver commander than to be able to put up a final protective fire of, 155 munitions in front of my position that the enemy's got to try and, get through. So I would say, no, cannons aren't quite ready for the scrap heap, and there are modern munitions that are being developed for cannons that, are just as lethal as the things that come out of the rocket. So, you know, once again, you look, our buddies, the Russians, which has always been described as a artillery-based army with tanks, the Red Dot of War, they're not retiring their cannons. They're making them more lethal. They're adding more lethal, rocket systems. What does this mean for the battlefield of the future? You know, when you get in a peer-to-peer fight, we've been fortunate. We've overmatched. We had a pretty, you know, third-rate enemy that we fought in both Desert Storm and in Iraqi OIF-1. So we didn't take a lot of casualties. He had some great systems out there, but he really wasn't trained to use them and employ them to the max effect that he could have got out of them. That's why if you remember that, you know, when they ran simulations before Desert Storm, they were predicting tons of casualties.
Right.
Because in the simulation, you had guys that could employ those weapon systems to their full potential. Didn't happen in when you got out on the battlefield. So, you know, one thing I would say is, hey, we better stand by because there's going to be a lot more casualties that we're going to be dealing with. And as, you know, they say, when you get in a fight like that, battles are won by the remnants of units. And so you better have a trained unit where you've got guys ready to step it up and move into a, you know, position, and you can operate in a degraded mode when you've lost personnel or equipment. So I would tell you, I don't envy anyone going into a peer-to-peer fight on today's battlefield.
Talk to me about I lost the question I was going to ask you. Hold on. It'll come to me in a second. It had to do with oh, Mike, when you, if you were going to point somebody in a direction about reading, I often talk about the on the program that the last time that we fought somebody that would close with us were the battles of Northern I Corps and up in Leatherneck Square in Vietnam, where the Marine Corps took on, or Third Marine Division took on the North Vietnamese Army. And those stories about those fights are epic stories. And so if you were going to point somebody in the direction to study what it is to fight a peer, they could bring it against you, where do you point them? What do you tell them to read?
Well, first of all, I would say I envy today's, soldier scholar or Marine scholar because of the stuff that's out there at your fingertips, at the, with, again, modern digital, technology. I mean, the fact that you can go through the Gazette archives, of course, you've got to be a member of the Marine Corps Association, which I know all Marines are.
Hello.
At least,
hello.
So, you can, and the Field Artillery, Journal, all of that stuff's online. And so you can go through and search those, and you can read about, hey, how do we employ artillery in Guadalcanal? How do we do it at the Chosin Reservoir? You've got firsthand accounts out there that you can readily access, at your, fingertips. And, oh, by the way, you can save them and, you can make them searchable. And, instead of carrying around like I did for my career, 50 boxes of professional, books, you can carry that around on a, on a thumb drive these days, or a flat, an external drive in your pocket.
You get it.
On your phone.
Yeah, you keep it on Kindle on your phone and all the downloadable books. And, oh, by the way, to me, one of the things I really lament that was not around when I was learning was Google Earth. I mean, I have that hangs in my garage today, a topographical map of the world, because you can't see terrain on some of those black and white maps in books. And if you want to, and I first had to do this when I was trying to understand, the battles on the Eastern Front in World War II. And I'd read, Lost Victories, or I'd read, I read a whole series of books about it. And the battles are, they're beyond the scope of comprehension these days. I mean, they're so big over such vast expanses, blah, 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 blah. And you read them, and you had this bullshit black, Lost Victories, you had five bullshit black and white maps in the book. Right? Because that's what they could afford to produce, or what they decided to produce. And now you can go and you can look at the places where they did this stuff. You can look at the terrain. You can see, the dilemma that terrain posed to them. You could see how that geographically, there was only certain lines of communication they could use. And so I really envy that, in case you can't tell.
Well, the other thing I would tell folks, again, get onto the Marine Corps Lessons Learned sites, and also the Army Center for Army Lessons Learned. I mean, there is a ton of stuff out there that is phenomenal, things that you can read that will improve your warfighting skills. So, I mean, those are, sites you should be perusing, quite often. The other thing I, tell people is take advantage of, I call them free training opportunities. When I was a battalion commander out at, Camp Pendleton, I was getting ready to go on a CACS, and I hadn't been on a CACS since I was a first lieutenant, because, back at, my initial duties stationary 29 Palms, because when I was a captain, I did UDP, so I didn't go on, a CACS then. So I hadn't, the CACS program had morphed quite a bit, and I hadn't seen it. So, I said, hey, can I come along and do a ride-along with the, the Coyotes, to kind of see what's going on with the CACS program? And it was like, oh, absolutely, So I was able to go out there, just, spend a day or two and see what was going on. And when I was at Leavenworth, I had been exposed to the, to the National Training Center and all the stories about the NTC. When I was a lieutenant and captain at Fort Sill as an instructor, all everyone talked about was their time in Germany up on the Fulda Gap. Well, by the end of the, when I went back to CGSC, Command and General Staff College in, 1990, all everyone in the Army was talking about was their NTC rotation. And, of course, most of the guys went there and got their ass kicked by the Op 4. And we actually, when I was in SAMS, I did the second year there, we went out to the NTC, and they had a program which allowed you to shadow the maneuver unit that was, as they call it, in the box. And they would give you, here's the tactical situation. And so we developed our plan, and then we compared it to what the guys in the box were doing. And then we went out and watched their battle unfold and watched them get their ass kicked. Which was interesting because, hey, they had a good plan, but it was like, well, what happened to the wire, that the obstacle? Oh, that thing you put in, observation and lazy team didn't get to the right hill.
Right. Or they got interdicted, blah, blah, blah.
You were part of the Op 4. You know what it was. You went out and killed all those guys. And,
well, what was amazing is that those Op 4 guys, they operated so much. They knew time distance. They knew, they were battle-hardened in terms of operations at Irwin. They knew they knew what they could expect. They knew the capability of their Soviet equipment, of their Soviet, they played like they had Soviet communications gear, and we operated completely in the clear. I tell, you probably heard me tell the story, but we were supposed to have a meeting engagement with the guy who was the officer of the brigade was John Antal, who wrote a lot of stuff about recognition prime decision making. John Antal, he was the officer for this brigade, I think out of Fort Riley in Kansas. And so we're in the middle of the back brief, and all of a sudden, the ops, master gunnery sergeant of this Army unit, of the Op 4 guys, comes over to the OPSO, and he says, all right, everybody stop, right? They've LD'd. There's been a mistake, and the Coyotes can't stop them. So we will execute this, right? And then he gave a reference point on the map. Same scheme of maneuver. We will execute it at this northing. And you're like, Roger. And we get in our view, and we did it. And we changed frequencies, I think, 16 times during the fight. 16 times we operated in the clear, they jammed us, and we still won. It was probably one of the most professionally enriching experiences that I ever watched my NCOs and Marines go through, because they would sit and take notes on the way they did their train models, the way they always did back briefs, the way they always did rehearsals, right? And you had to get on this big terrain map that they would build for the battalion, right, for the regiment. And it was talk about troop leading experiences on steroids. And like you said, if you don't avail yourself, right, to those things, and if you don't get out there and take away the lessons learned that these units that are operating in this environment are learning, shame on you. Because my Marines love that stuff. And one of the greatest compliments my company got while we were up there, we first get there and we're part of the intro brief where they get everybody together, and it's mostly the same people, but we were going to be a separate maneuver battalion. We were a BDRM, reconnaissance organization. And so the colonel, the brigade commander, says, and to you Marines with your LAVs, he says, good luck with those things. He said, I think I could throw this cigarette right through one of them, right? And then in this meeting engagement, we wound up with our hammerhead toes, right, holding this key piece of terrain, with our agility and guile, and the quick thinking of Marines, who after they shot every time they moved, right, and, our use of supporting arms. And we held these guys up in a kill zone, as you said, for artillery, and the artillery hammered him, and he got up at the hot wash, if you will, and he said, "Where are those Marines?" And everybody knew what had happened, and he looked at us and he goes, "Well done, Marines." He said that was awesome. He said, "It's been awesome having you guys here, and today was you all did absolutely great." And it was the work of our NCOs and our staff NCOs that took advantage of opportunities like that you're talking about, Mike.
Well, and what I did, so when I was a battalion commander, I said, "Hey, let's go do ride-alongs with these guys." So I took my battery commanders and staff, and we went up, and the first one we did a ride-along with a unit on the friendly side. And what I took away from that, I said, I was riding with the observer controllers, the werewolves, or the guys that do indirect fire. So I was riding with the werewolves, and I listened to this brief they did at night. And I said, "Holy shit, these guys got better situational awareness on this unit that's in the field than the unit has it on itself." And they had this great briefing format. I said, "Man, we took that format and we used that. We would call it our daily update." So at 2000, everyone would come up on the net and anyone could listen in, and we would go through this brief that was, based on what we had learned, to make sure everyone's got the same number of targets, everyone's got their same number of fire plans, where everyone's located, any issues they've got, that they need to be resolved. We would do it at 2000 because that gave us all night if we had to fix things, like if someone didn't have the right, number of targets, or they had a major end item that was down, we could send a maintenance team out to, work at it at night. So, that was a takeaway we had. Then we went out and watched a live fire and learned from that. And then, like you say, I've after going twice and getting tired of seeing, actually three times, I've gone and seeing the Blue Force get their ass kicked every time. The final time I said, "Hey, let's ride along with the Op 4. And so that was exactly as you described. I mean, the experience I had was we had this, it was the regiment in the attack. I rode along with this captain who was a battalion commander for a motorized rifle battalion. And they did decision point tactics where they did not decide what their plan was until as they were in the attack, they eliminated friendly courses of action. And then finally, about 2 hours into the attack, committed to what was going to be their main effort. Everyone flowed there, and they just blew through the, friendly force. And oh, by the way, the motorized rifle regiment commander got killed, and the young captain that I was riding with, he became the motorized rifle regiment commander. And, boom, on the fly, he's got it. And, off we went.
No, so it was I'll tell you what, you talked
about. It was phenomenal.
Yeah, it was such a good experience. So to me, as you said, if you don't make hay of those opportunities, and it changed the way my company operated. We had all the mortar cans full with, spray paint, with stakes, with cards, and you wiped them off and you used them again, and they sat and they took very deliberate notes of how big the terrain's model has to be so that everybody can get on it. And not only did you have to get on it, when you were on it, you had to have your one of your arms pointed out in the direction of orientation, which would all of a sudden you'd notice something like, wait, why are you turned that way? Well, wait a minute, aren't I supposed to? No. Oh. And so you saw this thing unscrew itself, and it was pretty interesting. All right, now you've been very generous with your time.
Yeah, and I'll give you one last thing, though, Mac. And
sure.
That's everyone should retain a gouge, whether it's a gouge book, a gouge disc. I was, most of my career was information age stuff, so I still got binders filled with, hey, I would see an article and I would photocopy it,
Right.
On whether it was on leadership, whether it was on something technical, on artillery, whether it was about, fire support. And I just would build that, binder. Now I have my, gouge folder where you know, I grab a PDF and I just slam it in there. So, you know, all that stuff, you know, as you see something, because, you know, you'll always see something and then you can never find it again.
Right, right,
so,
right.
You know, that's one thing I would recommend is anytime you see something that you think is, you know, really strikes you, you know, make a copy of it and slam it into a, you know, a folder somewhere where you can access it later. Because, you know, sometimes you got to read things two or three times to really appreciate the, you know, what's in there.
And then your understanding of it changes as you gain more knowledge. And I talk about that relative to, you know, listening to General Zinni. The way what I hear now is very different from what I heard when I was a young captain, and it has evolved constantly. And it's why you should re-listen to stuff like that over and over. I have two more questions for you. You've been very generous with your time. The first question is, you have been of great encouragement to me relative to the whole post-traumatic winning and the discussion of post-combat related mental health. I would be remiss if I didn't, you know, give you the floor and say your thoughts on that as you've watched this thing grow, because you've been a fan from pretty much the start. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I, you know, you're doing great work there, and I fully appreciate everything and support everything you're doing, and all those, you know, guys like General Furness that are embracing, you know, what you're doing, and other commanders that you've talked about. Good on them. This is something, again, I got interested in back in, you know, when I was at Leavenworth. I was really struck as we were reading all these theorists and stuff on, you know, understanding the moral dimension of, you know, combat, the psychological side of combat. And I actually wrote a monograph. My first monograph I wrote was, you know, how to understand stress on the battlefield. And in my case, I wrote how to use it as a weapon. How do you weaponize stress on the battlefield? But that whole thing gave me an understanding that, you know, psychological aspects, we don't like to talk about them. For example, I read a book called American Samurai. It was about the 1st Marine Division in World War II. And by the time they got to Okinawa, the number of psychological casualties that the 1st Marine Division suffered on Okinawa were absolutely staggering, you know. But hey, I'd never heard anyone talk about that, you know. And so, you know, I had never heard people talk about, you know, the importance of getting sleep so you maintain your cognitive, you know, decision making abilities. And so, you know, I became a early, you know, I developed that interest early and carried it through the, you know, rest of my career. And so, you know, again, it's something that we just don't do well. You know, we've got to be stoic Marines. You know, you can't show, you know, weakness. And, you know, as a result, folks have suffered for it. So kudos to everything that you're doing and the folks that are embracing it, because it's something that's going to be there. And if you think it's bad now, if we get into a peer-to-peer fight, stand by. You can magnify it by about 1,000. And you're going to be dealing with it not only post-traumatically, but you're going to be dealing with it real-time on the battlefield.
The final question I'll ask you is actually happened, and just so everybody knows, we've recorded this, but during this interview, and that is supposedly the Secretary of Navy has been, I don't care what you, his resignation was asked for by the Secretary of Defense. Would you care to make any comment on that? I tweeted, it's, everybody loves to talk about speaking truth to power, but not everybody likes to do it, especially when it's going to cost them, a pretty significant position. Your thoughts on that? You're no stranger to the whole discussion about moral courage and living it as opposed to just discussing it.
Yeah, I mean, I say kudos to Richard Spencer for, you know, standing up for what he felt was right. And, you know, again, as we talked about it, you know, I've listened to your discussions on the topic, and I agree with your you know, discussions that, you know, the SEALs got major problems that need to be dealt with, and you've got some guys that are trying to deal with them, and, you know, it's sad that this whole thing, you know, got tried in social media without, you know, the benefit of, you know, really having probably all the facts for, you know, our commander-in-chief, and he decided to, you know, do what he has done. But I think, you know, Mr. Spencer and those admirals that have, you know, towed the line and put their careers on the line, we need more folks like that in our, you know, military. And perhaps we wouldn't have seen some of the things we've seen going on over, you know, in the last, you know, 16 years, well, actually 18 years now since the global war on terrorism.
Yeah.
Maybe we wouldn't see some of the things that have happened had more folks been willing to, you know, stand up and, you know, look themselves in the mirror and say, hey, I'm going to do what's right.
Well, and again, it's kind of ironic, but, you know, this issue is about a SEAL who was not convicted. That doesn't mean you're innocent, and everybody needs to understand that. The fact that we don't have the we cannot prove it to the extent that we want to, and he was found guilty of lesser charges. But what you, in my opinion, what you're watching is the SEAL community who isn't having it. The platoon comes home, right? The CEO of that platoon that got sent home, he and the senior enlisted guy, they're suing, I want to say, the senior SEAL, you know, in court, for God's sakes, because they're not having it either. Because as long as the President of the United States has your back, you have carte blanche to do whatever you want to do. And I think it's just, I think it's horrible what's happened. And I agree with you. You know, God bless, you know, the Secretary of the Navy, former Marine, Richard Spencer, for doing the right thing. You know, we have an obligation, a moral obligation, to do the right thing. And if the President decides to set it apart, then that's his prerogative. But while we're in charge, we'll do the right thing. And if somebody doesn't like it, then they can ask for my resignation. I only wish that, you know, Secretary Esper would have looked at the President and said, you know what, Mr. President, if you ask for that, they're doing the right thing. If you ask for that, you'll get my resignation too. And so.
Well, how many people now, how many guys are going to go to office hours and tweet that, you know, hey, I'm getting railroaded, and, you know, tweet to the, you know, the President, hey, I need you to get involved with my, you know, court martial. I'm a war hero, and, you know, I've made a couple deployments and earned a couple ribbons, and, you know, now I'm being treated shabbily by the chain of command. So, I mean, it's a dangerous precedence to set. So, and I know that many, I think some of the retired folks, retired general and flag officers have spoken out on that, you know, this is a precedence that is, we're crossing the line that maybe open Pandora's box here.
Right. Mike, first of all, this has been a long time coming. To all you Artie guys that have never got to talk to Mike Marletto for this long personally, too bad, so sad, man. The Grunch just crushed it. So I hope this is the first in a number of times that you come on All Marine Radio. Your reputation as a leader in the 1st Division, I had never met you till you sent that email, and then we had dinner not too long ago, but I had heard about this guy, Mike Marletto, and what a quality guy he was, and that it was the division's loss that you didn't go back with us in 2004 in some capacity with the 1st Marine Division. But I'd heard about you, and so it's been obviously a pleasure to meet you and get to know you. But thank you very much for doing this, and I hope in the future when we talk about leadership, when we talk about peer-to-peer war, when we talk about cannons and rockets, that you'll come back on and give us the pleasure of hearing your thoughts on it.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Mac. Again, you're doing great things. I love the show. You know, I listen. I try to you know, because of the time difference down under, I, you know, usually try and hit your podcast and then load that up. And while I'm doing stuff, listen to the, you know, podcast. But, you know, again, there's a, I would tell your listeners, if you haven't gone into the archives of All Marine Radio, there's some great stuff in there. And, you know, again, it's another resource that you need to take advantage of. So thanks again, and keep up the great work, that all the things that you're doing with post-traumatic winning. As we talked previously, I've noticed they've got the same issue going down on down here in Australia. So maybe we can spread the wings internationally of what you're, the great work that you're doing.
Well, just so everybody knows, Marletto's got that for tasking, okay? So, so do, hey, do not screw that up, Mike.
All right.
All right. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.